100 years ago, W.E.B. Du Bois published a series of essays that examined America's tortured struggle with race. The volume was called The Souls of Black Folk, and the collection had an immediate impact because it spoke not just of pain and anger, but also of the dashed hopes and unrealized potential of people whose lives were forever constricted by the color of their skin. Du Bois braces readers for these ideas in the forethought to his book, read here by the author and cultural critic, Turay.
Herein lie buried many things which, if read with patience, may show the strange meaning of being black here at the dawning of the 20th century. This meaning is not without interest to you, gentle reader, for the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line.
A century later, Du Bois' thesis on the problem of the color line still reverberates, and it continues to influence America's ongoing debate about race. W.E.B. Du Bois' career as a public intellectual went on for 60 years after the publication of The Souls of Black Folk. He was one of the founders of the NAACP. Both a scholar and a schoolteacher, he wrote more than 20 books and hundreds of essays. But his most storied work is without question The Souls of Black Folk. The volume actually received mixed reviews when it was published on April 18, 1903. But the book, which was part scholarly manifesto, part personal narrative, was the first of its kind to be written by a person of color. Du Bois' Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer, David Levering Lewis, says it is the book's extraordinary prose that captivated the public.
As readers read this short book, they were really given a canvas of life in terms of politics and economics and culture that had never been presented before, and done with a command of the language, an inflection of the Bible, of Shakespeare, and of a goodly number of other wordsmiths in the prose that made the ideas of Du Bois seem to have a kind of electric charge that really made all of this quite a unique concoction.
Du Bois writes with a good deal of passion, and the stories are very, very personal. This is not an academic journal, and some of the short stories, the story of John, for instance, who pulls himself up by his bootstraps, gets within striking distance of his lifelong goal, and then is struck down. There's a lot of heat within these essays, but not a lot of overt anger. He doesn't write with an angry pen. Is that part of what made the book so powerful?
Yes, it's, wouldn't you say, controlled anger. And here Du Bois, as time passed, perhaps changed his mind. But I think the premise is that the problems of the world come from ignorance. And the solution, therefore, to the problems is knowledge and information. And so this is what this book, with all of its passion, as you say, use of fiction, essays to do.
One of the other better-known passages from The Souls of Black Folk is the portion where he describes what he calls the peculiar sensation of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others, of measuring one's soul by the tape of a world that looks on in amused contempt and pity. This was something he called a double consciousness.
I think that this double consciousness of being a Negro and American, two warring souls in one dark body, as he so eloquently expresses it, did not mean that from then till now there would be this kind of schizophrenia. I think what he was really saying was this: a tension existed in American society as people were assimilated into it based upon class and race and opportunity, and that in time, the best of being African-American and the best of being Euro-American would meld, would blend, would converge. It should be recalled that Du Bois in 1903 is speaking of a condition that many Euro-Americans were speaking of, how to be an Italian in America, how to be a Jew in America, how to be an Irish person in America. But I think it's in that context that this double consciousness might best be appreciated.
Throughout his life, Du Bois believed that the most potent weapon against racism for black Americans was education, specifically the training of black men.
So here we stand among thoughts of human unity, even through conquest and slavery. the inferiority of black men, even if forced by fraud, a shriek in the night for the freedom of men who themselves are not yet sure of their right to demand it. This is the tangle of thought and afterthought, wherein we are called to solve the problem of training men for life.
Today, most people who read The Souls of Black Folk are introduced to the book through assigned reading in college. But contemporary readers often find that their personal experiences all these years later are still reflected in the book. Jeff Johnson is a senior and a Pan-African Studies major at Kent State University.
One of the essays that is about the training of black men, and he's talking about HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, asking the question how relevant their training is, and is it really supplying them with the life training that they need, not only to gain good careers, but to build a strong economic force within the black community. Those are questions that we still need to ask, because there are more black males in jail than there are black people in college. So the college issue for African Americans is a huge issue, considering if we don't attend, then we're certainly at a huge disadvantage.
In the early 1900s, Du Bois began to champion the cause of Pan-Africanism, the idea that all people of African descent are linked through their history and as such have common interests and goals. Starting in 1919 and ending in 1945, Du Bois organized several Pan-African congresses in cities as varied as London, Paris, and Lisbon. Here is Du Bois speaking in New York in November 1952.
5 generations ago, my forefathers were transported from West Africa by force to toil on the plantations of America. Here we have lived for 3 generations. Mingling our blood with that of Europe and Asia, becoming citizens, soldiers, and contributors to the culture of the United States, but always loyal to the great motherland of Africa and seeking to serve its best interests.
But interest in Pan-African thought began to diminish with the rise of the civil rights movement in America.
I would sort of stress the fact that it's not so much that it has died out as that it has just changed.
Deirdre Badejo is professor and chair of the Pan-African Studies Department at Kent State University.
I think that it lost steam if you're speaking in terms of the United States and where the African descended population is in the United States, is because of the appeal of the civil rights movement. And that the quest for equality in the United States and the desire to be affiliated with the power structure in the United States sort of turned people's heads away from these larger global issues and have them more focused on national issues. There should not be a tension between the civil rights community and the Pan-Africanist community, that there should, in fact, be a meeting of the mind and an acceptance of the fact that one group will focus more on national issues and one will look at issues of globalization and the interrelationships of people of color in the Western Hemisphere and on the African continent.
But Du Bois is remembered most vividly for his views on America. And 100 years after The Souls of Black Folk was published, one is left to wonder, what would Du Bois think of the state of blacks in America today?
I think if Du Bois were to come back today, he would say, wow, not only the color line has persisted, but you people had 100 years to do something about it. And what have you done?
Andrew Hacker teaches at Queens College in New York City. He's the author of the book Two Nations, Black and White, Separate, Hostile, and Unequal.
What is interesting, fascinating, and depressing is that America is essentially as racially segregated today as it was in Du Bois's time. Now, why segregation? Is it a matter of choice or is it imposed? Well, the answer is it's first imposed. Then later on, people may say, well, I like to live among people, you know, I'm on friendly terms with, where I can be relaxed. But the fact is that black Americans do not have a choice as to where they can live, not nearly to the extent. For example, an Asian, a Chinese, person of Chinese descent, getting off the plane, becoming a Chinese American, has about 8 to 9 times more free choice of where he or she, their family, can live than has a black American whose people have been here for four centuries. I'm very uneasy about using the word ghetto. It's too much of a shorthand. But what we have, both in inner cities and, hey, don't overlook this, in rural towns, Mississippi, Alabama, and of course, all throughout the South, is essentially a wall built around black people.
Du Bois' biographer David Levering Lewis agrees, though he says Du Bois might conclude that today's problems stretch beyond the color line.
I think he would say that although color remains pertinent, the problem today is the cash line. Our concerns are not going to be raw race concerns, Du Bois would see that, but they're going to be the business of the distribution of resources. And Du Bois would say that the market cannot solve social problems. It really creates them without the input of a conscientious and alert citizenry and a government that stands by as umpire and as occasionally intervener in the economic sphere.
Toward the end of his life, W.E.B. Du Bois' political views became increasingly more socialist, and he joined the Communist Party. He moved to Ghana, where he died in 1963. Du Bois is remembered as a great American intellectual with a broad agenda, ranging from racism to economic injustice, both here and abroad. But his legacy and his ideas still resonate today, largely because of a small and revolutionary book called The Souls of Black Folk. To hear personal recollections of people who've read The Souls of Black Folk and previous stories about W.E.B. Du Bois, log on to npr.org.